everyone. Welcome to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zeman, and I am super excited to talk with this guest. But before I do, please be sure to listen to those two code words so that way you can get your free BACB CEUs. The guest that I have tonight, I'm so excited about. This girl is a really, really good friend of mine. I've known her for probably about a year now. And she is a lot like me. She is neurodivergent. She's autistic herself. And I'm super excited to be diving into the world of supervision and the world of ABA. So that being said, please help me with welcoming someone that I consider to be a really great friend and a really great person. Her name is Michelle Vinokourov, and she is a BCABA. Welcome to the podcast, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me on here, Michelle.
Yeah, you know, the tables have definitely turned. That's something that I mentioned during our podcast briefing. Fun fact, I've actually been interviewed by her before. So definitely make sure to check her out on YouTube. Your YouTube channel, by the way, is so what is your YouTube channel for our listeners?
So my YouTube channel, it's pretty much based off of my blog website called The World of Autism. So I connected with my YouTube and social media accounts with that.
I love it. Yeah, Michelle does a lot of interviews between her YouTube channel, and she also has a really great Instagram page, Self Advocate MV. She works for Full Spectrum, so she's really got a lot going on in terms of, you know, being a BCABA and just being a really awesome self advocate. So really excited to have her on tonight. Awesome. Well, first, let's talk about how you got into the field. So what inspired you to become a BCABA?
So for me, I know not too many autistic people have had experiences with ABA therapy. But for me, when I was younger, that was actually one of my early intervention services that I had after I was diagnosed with autism around the age of two. And I had other intervention services 7 days a week, which people will never hear that nowadays. But yeah, ABA therapy was one of my services, and it was really impactful for me, especially as a young adult now. I pushed it even more. It wasn't just because of my experiences personally, but also professionally. I worked in a autism self-contained classroom back in New Jersey. I live in Florida now, but back in New Jersey, in a autism self-contained classroom. It was with autistic students in kindergarten through fifth grade, and they were applying a lot of like naturalistic teaching approaches, also a mix of other approaches like DTT, and like really getting to work on individualized like programs and stuff, which I enjoyed so much that I actually ended up going back to school for my bachelor's. And that's where the whole journey began, really. And ever since then, like when I came down to Florida and everything, I was still in school online, but I pursued with becoming an RBT and connected with Full Spectrum ABA. And at the same time, I'm also, just so people know today, I also work as a behavior specialist for a public school district. So it's been such a journey. And for me, it's really making an impact on the lives of neurodiverse people. It's so crucial, especially like with making sure that people understand that we can apply more compassionate, individualized approaches.
You know, and it's so great to hear that too, because a lot of us in the field tend to get a lot of flack for going to ABA, because we get told ABA is abusive, and that's really hard for me as a neurodivergent person to hear. But that being said too, I mean, you're doing the work of, you know, yes, we're using ABA, but we're using ABA to change lives for the better. And that's what I truly appreciate about you being a BCABA, is that, you know, you want to change our clients' lives for the better, ultimately.
Oh, absolutely. I know I've seen this online too. Whenever, even if I've ever posted stuff that having to do with ABA therapy, I actually used to get a lot of that negative feedback about it, because really the truth is that, you know, ABA therapy is such an evolving field that obviously, like, we want to make sure we're respecting people's experiences, because everybody's experiences are so true and valid, because, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into play in regards to, like, the quality of the service, the type of therapist that people have worked with. Like, it makes a big difference. And so, like, for me, like, I've noticed when I really get down to the client's individual levels and everything, it's really has made such a huge difference. Like, I'll give one example right now, is that I've had recently a student in the school setting who's gone from being in a self-contained classroom, who used to have a lot of aggression, to now being, we got to do a change of placement recently to a full-time general education classroom under my supervision and help and everything. So it just really means a lot, and it makes a big difference when people have like an open mindset to wanting to make a difference. And that's the key thing.
And that's so awesome, first of all, that you were able to do that under your supervision, under your guidance. You got that kid in a different placement. And the fact that, again, you know, we get told these things about ABA being abusive, you know, but we're both neurodivergent. We both know that the science of ABA can absolutely change lives for the better. I mean, look at what your kid did. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do positively within our field. And, you know, I think it can be really tough to hear that. But at the same time, one thing that I've seriously learned is, you know, that we need to, when we're using our science, we want to make sure that we're being as compassionate and being as, you know, client-centered as possible. I feel like that should go without saying.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, like, one of the biggest things that I will say I've noticed, even in the school settings, is how much that we're putting on so much with compliance. And I don't agree with that, because of the fact that, like, it only drives people away when we're focusing nonstop on compliance rather than, like, being collaborative instead, and actually, like, really providing choices to the individual, so that way there's more of that natural engagement rather than, like, all full-on compliance.
You know, I'm so glad you said that. Collaboration over compliance. I'm going to coin that term now, because honestly, that's what it should be, right? You know, I don't know about you. I don't know what it was like for you going through your fieldwork hours, but for me, I remember being told, you know, we had to follow through with the demand in place. And if we didn't follow through with the demand in place, then, oh my gosh, we're reinforcing the behavior. And, you know, there was all of these things where we had to just stick to this one specific thing, and we weren't allowed to give the child a choice. I still remember having supervisors telling me, oh, you reinforced this behavior. And it's like, but why can't I give him a choice? Why can't he or she be able to, like, acknowledge, hey, I don't want to do this. I want to do something else instead. Did you have that experience going through your fieldwork supervision at all?
A little bit at first, but then it really depended on the supervisor. So I've had one supervisor who was like that, and then over time I actually expanded my range of, like, supervisors, and that's where the school district kind of came in too. So I had from both the school district and with full spectrum ABA that I was going through supervision hours. And most of the supervisors were really on board about with, like, really focusing on providing choices, so it makes it more engaging with clients they work with and everything. And it's so much better that way, because you're not going to see as much behaviors when we're working together with the client instead. You know, like, for example, if a client, like, do you want to do work by yourself or do you want to do work together? Like, little things like that make such a huge difference.
They really do. And you know, it's so interesting because, you know, one small modification can make the biggest difference. Something as simple as you don't have to work at the table if you don't want to. We can work on the floor. We can work at the couch. You know, we can do this activity somewhere else. It's not like, you know, we're going to be stuck in this one area, like, or stuck with this one task. Let's try to be flexible with our thinking. You know, we talk about ACT in our field, and ACT is all about flexible thinking and flexible things in general. And it's like, you know, we have to be a little bit more flexible in our thinking too, you know? Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Well, let me ask you this. How did presenting with peers during supervision sessions contribute to your growth as a supervisee and now a BCABA?
So for me, it was definitely like from the training perspective, like I've learned how to provide trainings now on like specific topics. So like not only in my work for the school district, but also for full spectrum ABA, I am one of the co-directors of the Autism Inclusion Program, by the way, for full spectrum ABA. And our program, we host forums every month for providers in the company. So I'm always doing trainings with the team on like, and it's other members are autistic and neurodiverse. So who are providers or even in various departments within the company, which is amazing. In regards to with supervision, like just being able to provide informative trainings about with like big topics like stimming to like what we were just talking about, like being more having more compassion over compliance, going through like burnout, like all these topics like that. So it's just that way providers are educated of like how to be proactive with clients they're working with. So like things like that, like kind of tying my own individual experiences growing up being autistic to also like real life proactive strategies rather than reactive, proactive strategies that we're using to help serve the clients that we're working with, then multiple settings. Because like I've now gained a lot of experience working in homes and schools, so I've expanded my broad, so it helps a lot.
Absolutely. You know, and it's so interesting because there was a point where I was thinking about like my own experience and thinking about how I would react to things. And I remember just talking to my supervisors a little bit about like, you know, my experience with stimming and my experience with my voice, because I've been told by a supervisor when I was doing field work hours how loud I am. And that's just a part of, I know. I love that you're glaring, because it's like, really, why is that even like
Yeah.
making, I'm a naturally loud and you know, I'm not gonna like, you know, justify my loudness, but sometimes I'm just really naturally loud. And you know, there have been times where I've had to like talk to my supervisor and just be like, look, you know, this is just part of me, and this is a part of how I've been able to do this, and this is what I've done in response. Even with like the stimming, I know that I know that there was a time where I did intervene on stimming behaviors because my supervisors did, and I felt like I had to do that. But then I realized, wait a minute, are they truly impeding the behavior? Are they impeding the are they impeding the child's learning at all? Because if it's not, then why am I doing this, you know?
Oh yeah, exactly. Like I have another story for with that. So I had a client in the school setting last school year when I was first starting off as a behavior specialist, and it was at this school, this t self-contained teacher, they didn't want to they kept wanting the child to sit down, and they're on the spectrum, and I'm like, it's not interfering with their learning, they're still listening to you. Like every time a demand was given, they'll follow through with it. So why are we making them sit down? Like they need movement, you know? Let them stand up. Like it's fine for them to move around.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that being said too, it's that much more important that that collaboration piece comes in, you know, where we're saying like, hey, I want you to take a look at what this child is doing. Yes, they may be getting up, they may be moving their hands, they may be, you know, another example I can think of is the fidget spinners, where, you know, a kid will take a fidget spinner and, you know, spin it around. And it's like, we all STEM in our own ways. Like, would you want me to suppress, would you want me to suppress your STEM? You know, how would you like that?
Yeah, it's, and like from there, like ever since then, like it's been a lot better since then. I go into the classroom now, same school. I still work with them this school year, and it's been a huge difference now. And not only that, the kids more included now. So like they were sitting in the back, now they're sitting in the front, so they have space to move around and everything. So it's like, now it's nice to see that they're included. Collaboration, people.
exactly, you know, and collaboration and feedback, you know, it's one of those things where it's super, super necessary, and also just really, really helps us to grow and helps our clients to do a lot of different things as well, you know?
Yes.
Oh man. Speaking of feedback, what type of feedback did you find most helpful when you were doing your fieldwork supervision?
So hands-on has definitely been the best kind of feedback, because I'm the type of person that visually needs to see what's going on. It does help with written too, because I'm visual that way. I'm not the greatest with auditory, so I need things either written or I need to see it myself and actually do it in order to get that kind of feedback. And this was both in and with the school district and with Full Spectrum ABA, like that, those kind of feedbacks were really beneficial during my supervision experience. And just so fun facts for you guys, it was just this year that I became a BCABA, like a couple of months ago.
Yeah, really, really awesome. You know, and it's so interesting because throughout my time of being a BCBA, so I've been a BCBA for, in 2025, when this comes out, it'll be my 9th year of being a BCBA. And I've been in the field for, gosh, it'll be 12 years this upcoming year. Wow, that's so crazy to think about.
That's, wow, time flies.
I know. But also, too, you know, we talk about feedback because everyone needs feedback, no matter how long we've been in the field for, you know. I know personally, I still benefit a lot from being given feedback, even on something as simple as like, hey, you could try this small little manipulation and then boom, you know, you might be able to see some change. And I'm glad that you mentioned hands-on feedback, because hands-on feedback has always been helpful for me too. Auditory is one of those things where like you tell me that and I'm like, okay, I got it. But, you know, 5 seconds later, I'm not going to remember it because you just told me, you know? So I definitely can understand that. Have you, when you're supervising, do you try to use a lot more like hands-on feedback, or do you have like a different mode of feedback that you give to your supervisees?
So for me, it's pretty much based on individual preferences. I always make sure to communicate and ask first, because you want to make sure that you're on the same page as them. And then that's where from there, like some people prefer the hands-on too. Some people prefer being spoken to, like giving feedback after it's occurred rather than in the moment. Not everybody likes in the moment. So it really, it's very individual basis. Just like when we work with clients, it's very individual basis.
Yeah, that's very, very true. You know, we always want to make sure that we are, you know, being as individualized with our feedback as possible. And yet at the same time, we also need to be mindful of how we want to get feedback as well, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it. And you mentioned too, communication, because communication, I mean, I feel like I'm one of those types of people that over communicates, and that can either be a really good thing or a really bad thing. It can be good in the sense that I want you to know if something is going on, but it could also, I could also see it being a bad thing in a way, because some people are like, stop, too much. But that being said, how did open communication with your supervisors support your progress as you continued on with your field work?
So for me, it's actually been quite helpful. Like my supervisors were all very helpful for me throughout my journey. Whenever I had a question, they're pretty responsive. They'll practice the 24-hour practice of if I'm reaching out via email or texting or whatever, they would respond within 24 hours. I've had in the school district during my supervision process, I actually met with my supervisor either in person or via Teams when it came to problem solving. So things like that. I've also had it through full spectrum ABA where we've had a required amount of time where we had to receive supervision. And so it kind of worked out in my schedule like that. So I was getting supervision in person a lot and everything. It really depends, private practice versus in the school district is very different, by the way. So in regards of field work. But overall for me, it was very helpful. I've learned a lot of tips and tricks that have helped me now being a BCABA myself. And when I'm writing plans now, my credentials are longer now. So,
Absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely. And on the note of, your field work experiences, because you mentioned school. Now, some of our listeners may only have private and more in-home and clinic experiences. So tell us how your field work experience was a little bit different in the sense that you worked in the schools.
So through full spectrum ABA, a lot of it was where I was getting one-on-one individual supervision sessions. There would also be group supervision sessions online via Teams with other analysts that were going for supervision hours, wherever it be like for a BCABA like myself or as a BCBA. And then in the school setting, it was where there's other colleagues of mine that are in the supervision process still, and I've finished mine. But we would get together in in-person group supervision sessions. Like that would be scheduled in every month, like once or twice a month, and stuff with my supervisor. And we've done presentations for each other on topics based on the task list. Both and that was that there are some similar things between with both the and full spectrum and the school district. So that was the one piece that was very similar was being able to practice providing trainings was one thing. Another thing was with behavior skills training, like having to come up with scenarios and actually using strategies like how to ask for a break, like teaching stuff like that, or asking for help, or problem solving, or social skills, like things like that. There was also with the school setting, I also did receive supervision in person, and over time, my supervision experiences kind of faded out because of how much more comfortable that my supervisor could tell I was getting. So it really depends because I know field work hours they change they're changing constantly. Like even the amount of hours you have to get, I know from the behavior analyst certification board, like they're changing the hours even in within the new year. So it's going to be very different for a lot of people pursuing it now. But it when I got it, through the school setting was a lot more fading out. At private, they really stick with you through it through the entire process. Like they're right there for you if you need anything in general.
Yeah, I definitely have noticed when it comes to the school setting, it's you're not on top of the child the way that you would be on top of them within a private ABA session where you're doing more of that one-to-one. I've been in schools, and I've experienced what it's been like. And I remember being in a school and the teacher was telling me, hey, feel free to take a step back. And it's like, oh, I definitely need to do that. I definitely need to take that step back because the whole point is to foster independence at the end of the day. The setting does matter. That's one thing that I had to really learn the hard way was that the setting and the environment that you're in, can definitely shape the type of teaching and how you actually do your job within your role. That's a really, it was a tough experience, but it was a great experience at the same time, you know?
Oh yeah, exactly. Like I've had to throughout my experiences, especially in the school setting more so than with full spectrum ABA, I've had to learn a lot with, especially with behavior skills training with teachers. Now that's been actually a lot of fun and experimenting a little bit because like my coaching skills are still being worked on. I do admit that. I try to communicate with teachers in the beginning of the school year, like about with like going through specific interventions for kids that on the kids' plans, even if I didn't write it yet and it was written by someone else that I consult with them on and be like, okay, what interventions do you understand in applying? If not, what do we want to work on? What do we want to focus on that needs a little bit more support with? And from there, like and this is where communication is like so crucial, important to have open communication, even with teachers that, you know, do you prefer having coaching sessions like with the kid there? A lot of times teachers will say yes about that because they want to see it like me modeling stuff with the kid that they're working with. So most of the time, some teachers like it when it's one-on-one without the students there, like being with them privately, going over, like modeling with them how to do it. It really just, again, depends how the teachers feel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and when it comes to that collaboration piece, what's been a challenge that you have faced being a BCABA in the classrooms and working with teachers? What has been like a challenge for you that really stands out and how did you work through that?
So the biggest thing, and it's still kind of a challenge because again, it's where we go back to the whole mindset. When people don't have an open, flexible mindset that the child can do things and you think that they can, then it makes it a lot harder to move forward with anything. And yeah. So, like, that's why for me, I've had to show, like, through the data, like, when I'm working with teachers, I'm collecting that data, and, like, all right, you're seeing through the data here that the kid is making progress, or, okay, maybe the kid needs a little bit more tweaking on interventions and stuff, so, like, and it's okay. It's just that one of the things is having an open mindset. That's the key thing. When you have an open mindset, the kids, they model whatever the teacher's behavior is. 9 times out of 10, that's what's mostly going on. So, like, if we're constantly giving redirections all the time, the kid's going to still continue to be off task. Now, if we're trying to catch the kid reinforcing what they are doing and you know, like being on task and catching those little things, it makes a huge difference and you won't see as much of those behaviors that we don't want to see. So
yeah, definitely, definitely. You know, I know sometimes that can be a little tough, you know, just trying to go in and, you know, because at the end of the day, like, you know, you're working with teachers in a classroom and it's their classroom, you know. It's not like we get to go in and kind of like we tell them something and they do something about right. it. Like, you know, it's their classroom.
Right.
So I can definitely understand that. Well, I'm going to go ahead and drop the first code word for the podcast. And that word is exceptional. So that is EXCEPTIONAL. That word is exceptional. So let's go back to when, I mean, I know it's only been a couple months, but I still feel it's more than relevant. When you first started as a BCABA, what challenges did you face when you were transitioning into that role from an RBT?
I'll be honest, it actually wasn't as hard as I thought it would be because of the fact that working for the school district, and at the same time, while I was still being an RBT for full spectrum ABA, but working for the school district, I kind of like was already getting that experience of writing plans and everything, doing that trainings for teachers, like doing behavior skills training. Like I was already starting to get that practice even before I became ABC ABA. So that was kind of a huge head start for me. Like I already was starting to expand my opportunities and everything right from the start. And Full Spectrum ABA has been like so supportive of my journey ever since then. And I, from that, it just made it so much easier that, like, as an RBT, you're doing a lot more one-on-one. Like, you're really more hands-on compared to when you're a BCABA or a BCBA, when you're doing a whole mix of things, not just all the time being one-on-one. You know, it's a mix of like even just like really working with teachers, working with families and stuff like that. So that's, I've noticed the one thing for sure is definitely just communicating more with the teachers and more of the community than you are as an RBT. Like, as an RBT, like for me, I would communicate like the progress that the kids make making and stuff. But as a BCABA, doing a lot more of the training side has been like the biggest thing that I've had to transition into for sure. And it did help me in my supervision field work getting that experience too, to practice that a bit. But yeah, that was the biggest shift would be with that, is doing more behavior skills training and like being from like focusing more on that coaching perspective, like being more like a coach and that collaboration part. So that's really been a key thing that's been helping me a lot.
That's really awesome. You know, it's really cool to hear like you were kind of able to jump start, but then also too, you know, we talk so much about, you know, at least like from what I've seen, people want to learn about assessments, people want to learn about, you know, different clients that they can work with and, you know, doing parent trainings. But coaching, I feel like sometimes gets missed, you know, and it's not because they don't want to do it. It's or they're not interested in it. It's just something that they don't really necessarily focus on first thing. It's more like, oh, as a BCBA, you get to assess these clients on different skills and different using different skills assessments, and you get to do parent trainings. You know, that coaching aspect is kind of something, a piece that I think sometimes gets missed. And
I
so
agree with that
yeah.
100% because I've noticed in the beginning of my supervision sessions, like it was more so a lot of with the assessment pieces, like how to do an FBA, like things like that. But really the reality is once you really get into the job and everything, like for me, it was actually more so with coaching than anything else really. Like maybe it was like 20% of the work I do now. It's not as much of writing plans. It's more so of coaching than anything, especially in the school setting. Like for me, like that I do is mostly on with coaching teachers, like providing feedback, like things like that. And because for me in the school settings, the teachers are more like my supervisees, really. Like I'm actually working with them as they're working with the kids and stuff. So it's like I have to build, like pair with not only the students, but also the teachers. Like pairing is in everywhere, a lot more so as the BCABA than just as an RBT where you're just pairing with the kid. You have to pair with pretty much everybody.
Oh yeah, you gotta pair with the teachers, you gotta pair with the students, you gotta pair with the environment, you gotta pair with the schedule, you gotta pair with everything. And it's like, how can you manage that? You know, like you would think, you know, when it comes to that coaching piece, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like, well, yeah, you know, as a supervisor, you're gonna supervise and you're gonna give feedback. But I feel like when I know personally, I feel like when I ran into situations like that, it's almost like that coaching piece gets neglected because they automatically assume, oh, hey, I'm already going to be doing this. And there's going to be some situations that are really, really difficult to maintain and manage, you know, thinking about difficult supervisees and difficult, you know, people to communicate with, you know, I know you mentioned the challenge that you had, you know, that's something we think about, and that's something that happens every day.
Oh, yeah, of course. Like, I remember speaking with that. So, in the school district, when I first became a behavior specialist, so like I didn't disclose myself at first of being autistic. Like I was going through the interview process just like everybody else, you know. So, few months in, and I actually was struggling in my job in the beginning because I had schools that didn't want me at their schools again. Like after I go through with visiting schools, like trying to help them cases and stuff for colleagues, at first, like the schools didn't want me because either I was like overstepping or not enough support. Like, what do you want?
Right.
So it was such a struggle. And then I'm like, the beginning of last school year when I was starting off and finally had my own schools, I had to literally sit down with my supervisor. I wrote a whole letter and everything, and based on like stuff like, all right, this is what I felt like I was struggling with. I want to disclose myself about with being autistic and everything. These are like some of the things that I feel like that can help me, like having like these kind of visuals and stuff, like how much should I be communicating, like things like that, like what are some protocols that can help me while I'm working with the schools. Ever since that meeting, like my supervisor's been like so accepting, and she actually even told me in the beginning of last school year, like she and my head boss, who's above my supervisor, we had a whole meeting and stuff eventually down the road with that. But they both asked me, like, have I considered disclosing at my schools and everything, being autistic and stuff. And actually it happened very naturally at my schools. It's been a huge difference. I have one of my schools that I've been working with now for the second year in a row, and they no longer try to do change of placements right away for kids and stuff. It's now like we actually are really trying to use interventions in place, and it's lowered the amount of change of placements and stuff, which has been huge. Just by even sharing my story alone. So it's really like it's been important, and I ever since then, like actually I've had people, thanks to me, like my team lead made a whole like share drive for our entire team of like resources and stuff. So it's really helped out big time. And I didn't even have to like ask for that much. Like it was just, it was a resource that can help everybody, really.
Yeah, first of all, I'm so glad that you did that. And I remember, when I was going into my first job as not even an RBT or an ABA therapist, but this was my first exposure to the field of autism. And I remember disclosing in the interview, and they were like, you need to be careful with saying that to anybody. And the reason why is, I guess, because I guess some of the students could use that against me. And I was like, okay, I can understand it from that perspective. And then I got more involved into the field. And then I was like, should I even talk about being autistic at all? Do I say this in the hopes that, I can reach somebody? Or do I say this kind of in a way to help my family sort of realize the potential that their child? Because I will be honest, I have disclosed my diagnosis to some of the families that I've worked with, and they've been very appreciative of that because they also kind of see it as like, well, I hope my child can be like you one day. And that's not always going to be the case. Like, unfortunately, I'm not the gold standard. But that being said, it's really interesting you talk about disclosing. And disclosing is one of those things that can really either be a really positive thing, like in your case, or it can be kind of not like, I guess it can be negative. And mine wasn't a negative experience, but mine was more of a eye-opening experience where, you do have to be careful with how you disclose yourself because it can ultimately end up out of your favor.
Yeah, pretty much the way that I have described myself, like I won't like directly say I'm autistic. Like I'll explain in a way that like these are my abilities of what I do, and then these are things that I basically of how I approach things, really. Like if I have to type things on the computer, that's my way of processing things, like things like that, or just like or even if I don't look at someone directly, like know that I'm listening, like kind of like things like that as a way of like approaching it rather than directly bluntly saying that I'm autistic. Like that's pretty much how I handled that with my supervisor. And after that, like they could tell when I first through the interview, my head boss, who's above my supervisor, she told me when she interviewed me, like she could tell.
Oh my
Like she was
goodness.
able to notice that I was autistic anyway. So I was like,
Oh.
yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, for me it was quite interesting too, 'cause like when I was 'cause now I'm actually a lot more open about being autistic in interviews, and I'll say like, you know, there are certain things that I do need a little bit of assistance with, and you know,
Yeah.
but I'll typically start with just like, yeah, you know, I just want to let you know I do have autism, and you know, it's a part of me, and it's a part of
Yeah.
my identity. And then like I've realized, especially in my job now, I've realized the importance of self-advocacy. And I've realized that that has sort of trickled into some of the supervisors and supervisees that I've worked with, in the sense of like, hey, if I need, for example, visuals, I'm a visual person just like you, in terms of like needing certain visuals to break down, needing certain written protocols, needing certain things to sort of help me figure out what I'm supposed to do in XYZ situation. Believe it or not, it doesn't just benefit me. It actually benefits a lot of people. Kind of like you, what you were saying is, it's not just benefiting you as the person, it's benefiting everybody.
Right. Like there are ways to incorporate things that works for everybody, you know. It's not like, you know, you just have to like sometimes you just have to like share your insights and everything. That's what I was trying to do. And I will say though, it was very different with the school job versus with full spectrum ABA. Full spectrum ABA, at the time when I was hired with them, it actually was before I became an RBT, and I was able to disclose right away with them because I know they were trying to develop a autism program anyway at that in the early stages then, so that's kind of why like I pretty much disclosed myself, and it was a little bit of a different twist with that one of my connections shared about me with them, so that's kind of like how that helped. But yeah, so ever since then, like it's really incredible, like the differences. And you know, when you have an environment that's like so opening and welcoming, it makes a huge difference.
It does. Trust me, it absolutely does. And I mean, I would scream that to the choirs, you know, like I absolutely agree that it really helps being in a place where people accept you for who you are, and you're able to, you know, like educate them in a way that is both kind, but also, you know, like this is what this is, and this is how this feels, and this is, you know, how we can do better. You know, I know that that lesson actually came up pretty recently for me. I had to talk a little bit about functioning labels with some of my fellow supervisors, and I'm not a fan of functioning labels as
Yeah,
you.
I'm not anymore either. I used to be in the past, but as I've learned more stuff, I'm like not really anymore. I'd rather say abilities and challenges versus like all these labels.
Yeah, same. I'm a strengths and supports person. So
Yeah.
find strengths in this and need supports in XYZ.
Right.
And I remember somebody dropped high functioning autism. And granted, this was part of an assessment tool name. I think it was like the AIM or something, if I remember correctly. And I just remember being like, this is not an okay thing to say. And I felt very uncomfortable. And so then and it's so interesting. I actually reached out to my supervisors after that meeting and was like, hey, I'm not very comfortable with that verbiage being said. I know this is part of an assessment tool. And they were really supportive. They actually said, like, hey, use that opportunity to educate. And so I did. I ended up saying, hey, you know, I understand that this is part of an assessment tool name, but here's some of the harmful effects of using functioning labels. And I try to do that with my supervisees a little bit. I try to tell
Yeah.
them, like, you know, it's important to know that, yes, we can sit here and we can say functioning labels and, you know, verbal and nonverbal and all of that. But then when you put it into perspective, you're not really like showing your student in the best light. You want to show them what they're great at, what they need a little bit more help with, how they're able to communicate, because everybody has verbal language and everybody communicates non-verbally too. It's just how they communicate. Do they use vocal verbal language, or do they use an AAC device as their way of engaging in verbal language? You know, it's a lot of things that you said.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yes. No, but in all seriousness though, like, I know that those are definitely opportunities that really do come up. And that's something that, like, when we're educating our supervisees, you know, we want to make sure that we're being as compassionate as possible while also trying to, like, teach, hey, this is what this is, you know. For example, when it comes to, like, what the community prefers in terms of first person and identity first language, it's so interesting because I'll hear, like, you know, oh, the community prefers this. And it's like, well, you haven't talked to everybody in the community, so how can you say that? You know, so it's lessons like that that we still have to disseminate, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because really, it's an individual basis again. It's all, it's just, you just have to ask, is all.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That being said, too, you know, as far as, like, your supervisees and stuff goes, you know, have you had opportunities where you've had to, like, really sit down and sort of, like, educate them on how, you know, we can approach our clients? And if so, tell me a little bit about that.
So the one that I was telling you about in the classroom setting where I had a student that's that they at first was making them sit down all the time because they were stimming. I had to literally educate them more so about what autism was in general, because of the fact that as I learned about the teacher, that they were brand new into working with this population, and like for students with autism and intellectual disabilities. So I had to literally like go over with them what it's like for autistic students and how it's different for everybody. Like, a lot of people like to move around and to stim because that's what's very soothing for them. And it's okay to let them do that. Like, they will be like, people will still listen to you. It's just let them move around and stuff. So like things like that. And really, but yeah, some people, like, I've had to really educate of like what autism is, or even just on specific interventions and stuff, like what works. It really just, again, it depends on people's experiences. Teachers, I always approach it to where I get to know, like, when I'm in the pairing stages in the beginning of the school year, I like to have, like, personal conversations with teachers, like, get to know them, like, where they're at, how many years that they've been teaching and stuff. Like, I've had teachers share with me that they've never worked with the disability population before, so I'm like, oh, okay. So I see where we're going at. So yeah, so like going, breaking it down, like you're very basic, or if there are some who have and they have experiences and everything, then that's where it's, that's where I can like gauge of like, okay, this is what we can work with.
Definitely, definitely. You know, I feel like that advice is so sound, and it's really just so important to make sure that, yes, like we're still getting to know, like we want to educate people as much as possible, but we still have to pair at the end of the day. You know, we can't just go in and like be all gung-ho no matter where or what our experience is. You know, we have to tread water, like we're in their territory, and we can't just assume that we know it all. You know, we're not the leader of the classroom. We just, we're responsible for a classroom, but we're not necessarily the leaders of a specific classroom. We just, we're helping. We're that support system at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah. At the end of the day, it's like being that extra support for teachers and for families, and that's what they need.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Well, I'm going to go ahead and drop that second code for you. And that second code word is shell. That is S-H-E-L-L. That is the word shell. All right. So looking back, you know, looking back to when you first started in the field and, you know, becoming a BCABA, what would you say was the most rewarding part of your supervision journey?
The most rewarding part is my overall like growth of like even personally, not even just professionally, but personally too, in regards to how much that I really worked on, like including like my communication skills with people, to even just like my leadership skills when working with now, like with schools and everything. Like this year I have 5 schools I'm working with right now versus 4. So I have like, it's a lot more, like I've learned with like more responsibilities, learning at like how much it's so crucial to engage in self-care, as well as like making a balance and like time management and all that. So it's really like, not only like I've been making such an impact on the kids, but I'm also making growth in myself personally. And it's very rewarding overall, like just being in the field and everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I love that that is a main key component, you know, is where you were versus where you are. You know, I still think about baby BCBA Michelle, being a little bit, you know, later in the field. I still think about how baby BCBA Michelle and where her growth was, and how much more I've grown since being, you know, the person that I am today. And, you know, I think if there's one thing that I really advise, I mean, is basically the same thing as you, is, you know, look at your progress, look at how far you've come, and, you know, kind of like, you know, see that you did start here and you've grown so much as, you know, a leader, you've grown so much as a person, you've grown so much, not just as a person in the field, but as a neurodivergent person.
Yeah, and definitely the biggest thing too is really trusting in my own abilities and stuff, because there are people that are relying on like us and stuff and ourselves, really. So like trusting your own abilities and trusting others is like, that was definitely the biggest thing that I've learned over time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what would you say, my final question is, what advice would you offer to new people going into the field of ABA, especially those who are neurodivergent?
The most important thing is to be your authentic self, because that's whatever that you are modeling for clients, or when you're going to do coaching and training sessions with teachers and families in the community. It's really important to be yourself and be honest. That is one of our ethics codes, by the way, is making sure that we're being honest and truthful. So make sure that you're being yourself, because, and, you know, especially in our field, we are data driven, like use data to help guide and make decisions, important decisions for clients based on and advocate for their needs as much as, you know, because in this field, you learn how to advocate for yourself as much as you're advocating for clients too. So definitely be yourself, make the sessions fun, like no matter if it's school or home, and like do what's best for yourself and for the client.
I love that. That is such a strong piece of advice. And I really hope that our listeners really, really understand that, you know, when it comes to really being yourself, who you are as a person, whether you are autistic or neurotypical, or no matter where you are on the neurodiverse spectrum, if you're on it, you know, being your authentic self helps you show up. I know that, you know, in my time of being a BCBA and in my time of being in the field, it's definitely helped me in a lot of different ways. And that being said, you know, again, being your authentic self really does matter at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like every time I go into classrooms or homes, like if I'm working with clients and stuff, like I always see the biggest smile on their face every time they see me. So it's like, that's how you know, like just be yourself.
Absolutely. I love that. Thank you so much for joining me tonight, Michelle. Where can our listeners find you or contact you?
Sure. So on my social media platform, so my brand name is Exceptional Shell. My user tag name is Self Advocate MV. You can follow me on all social media platforms, including like my YouTube channel and stuff. And you can also make sure to check out my blog website known as The World of Autism, where I do share my personal experiences growing up with autism, as well as like being more informative, sharing like topics like with ABA therapy, and also having guest features. Like I've had Michelle on my blog website too. So make sure to
Yes.
check those out.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much, Michelle. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in tonight. I have been your host, Michelle Zeman. I hope you have a good rest of your night and take care. I'll see you on the next one. Bye.